welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. Get the pro treatment and design your very own custom Rawlings glove just like your favorite big league stars. Choose from countless patterns, web types, lace colors, and more to showcase your unique personal style. Start with a pro design and change it up with your team colors, or build yours completely from scratch with your name, number, and state flag. Visit Rawlings.com to design your custom glove today. Happy fielding. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. This week on the ABCA podcast is Latrobe University professor and former New York Yankee Dr. Luke Wilkins. Wilkins is a lecturer in sport and exercise psychology within the sport and exercise science department at Latrobe. He's subject coordinator for motor behavior and sport and talent identification and development. Originally from the United Kingdom, Wilkins obtained his PhD from the University of Birmingham, where he explored how visual, perceptual, and cognitive skills impact sporting performance. Between 2018 and 2020, Wilkins worked for the New York Yankees organization as a sports scientist and lead skill acquisition specialist. Wilkins is involved in a number of global research collaborations, which include projects exploring the use of the pink ball in cricket, the gaze behavior of baseball batters, and how virtual reality technology can be used to enhance sporting performance. This episode is a deep dive into Dr. Wilkins' research paper, a framework for using virtual reality to enhance psychological performance in baseball. You can also dig back into the archives and listen to episode number 260 to get tips on skill acquisition. Let's welcome Dr. Luke Wilkins to the podcast. All right, here with Luke Wilkins, lecturer in sport and exercise psychology at Latrobe University, but from 2018 to 2020 was here in the States with the Yankees, but has been on with me, I think we were saying 2.5 years ago, I think you were on with me last time. So, yeah. Luke, thanks for jumping on.
Yeah, no worries. Glad to be back. I think it was just before I moved to Australia, so yep. Would have been about 2.5 years ago. So,
hey, yeah. Did you work with Craig Morris, who's over here working with U.S. Tennis Association? He came and spoke. He does the grassroots project for tennis over here, and he had actually mentioned your name a little bit, so I put that in my notes from the youth summit we ran. It was cool because he's on the tennis side, but he came and spoke to our group about how to help youth baseball in the United States.
Okay.
Junior tennis does with different colored discs, different sizes rackets, different size balls, which we're hoping to try to influence that a little bit on the youth baseball side.
Obviously, lots of crossover with interceptive sports like that. I think I mentioned last time I had no knowledge of baseball until I joined the Yankees, but I have a very good knowledge of cricket. So a lot of crossover, and likewise with tennis, there'll be transfer of skills, so I can see how that works.
Yeah, and you published a paper that you sent to me. It's very, very interesting. It's called A Framework for Using Virtual Reality to Enhance Psychological Performance in Baseball. What was kind of your impetus to starting that?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Well, when I left the New York Yankees, what I'd been tasked with doing for the previous sort of 2 years was to bring in a virtual reality training program and training and testing, because We always think of virtual reality as training, but actually probably the biggest upside is just understanding the sport and the athletes better through virtual reality. And so when I left, they were looking to hire someone to replace me, but they weren't able to do that for a variety of reasons for quite a while. And so I was sat there worried that all this sort of 2 years of effort was just going to go to waste because it needs someone to drive it, right? Like, you can't rely on coaches, you can't rely on sport, you know, other sports scientists, because everyone's so busy that you need someone driving that. And if you can't get someone to drive it, then at least you need to have like a, here's how you do it, ready-made formula of this is who needs it, how, and why. And so that was kind of the inspiration behind putting together this framework, to try and sort of simplify how you would actually implement VR and when you'd implement VR and all those sorts of questions to try and ease that transition. Because, you know, if you're not, if you don't have expertise in that area, it's an easy thing to just go, okay, we'll leave it to the side for now and maybe come back to it. And that's understandable.
And let's go through you used six different cases to use for it. So I kind of want to get your thoughts on that. And the first one was obviously pitch recognition training.
Yeah, and, you know, a few of these are just things that players do anyway, right? Like, players do pitch recognition training, but they do it on iPads, on TVs, on phones. Players do game day scouting reports, again, on iPads, on computers, whatever it is. But what we're just saying is, look, there's huge advantages of doing it in VR instead. First of all, you get the sort of correct perspective, because a lot of the time on these iPads, you're doing it from sort of behind the batter's box, right? Or you're doing it from a slightly different angle, not quite the exact sort of perspective that you need, and that's important. And you can also actually interact with the world, I guess, as opposed to just watching it and tapping a button of whatever you think it's going to be. So we're just taking things that people do and just making it better, at least from our perspective. So that's the first two cases, is sort of pitch recognition training and then game day scouting. So,
and then pitcher strategy, which probably goes into game day scouting a little bit too, and how you're going to get pitched.
Yeah, a little bit. This is maybe my favorite one, because this is one where I think not many people would do it, because it's a little bit more of a long-term project. So the idea behind this one is that you're going to use virtual reality with hitters, right? Because pitchers are, you need to protect them so much and you don't want to increase their workload. So you're going to do it with hitters. But doing things with hitters allows you to understand what pitchers need to do to navigate it, right? It's just like a cat and mouse sort of thing. If you can understand what a hitter does well, you can understand what is needed to exploit that. So the example I always give is, you know, in the real world, it's difficult to ask a pitcher to sort of throw 10 pitches from here and then suddenly throw one from down here. It would be probably quite dangerous from an injury perspective and sort of very difficult for them to do in a really controlled and rigorous manner. But in VR, you can easily do that. So allowing you to do that allows us to understand, okay, is changing that angle of the pitch affecting how a batter sees the ball and where they're looking at? And if it does, then actually, can we train a 19-year-old pitcher to produce this sort of surprise pitch, as we would call it? And yeah, so there's that long-term element to that one, but something that I think would be fun to study and fun to investigate. So
yeah, because nobody ever thinks from the pitcher's viewpoint on that part of it.
100%. Yeah,
which is also why it's good, because you always come with a fresh set of eyes, where you come from a research based and science background, where you ask good questions, where somebody that's in it probably doesn't even think about that, but you're really good about asking good questions
and also asking bad questions as well. So because I don't know baseball as much as, you know, 95% of people in the world, you know, I'll ask these questions, and eight of them may be stupid questions, eight of them may be silly questions that, you know, an experienced baseball head laughs at. But two of them might be useful, two of them might be good, and if that's the case, then I'll take it. So,
and you mentioned post-game analysis then too. Is that almost reframing your at-bats, where you're going to go back and participate in the exact same at-bats you went through?
Yeah, you absolutely can do that. I think you can use it in a few different ways. So again, most sports have some sort of post-game analysis, looking back on particular plays and going, okay, what was the decision made there? Why did you do it? Have a discussion centered around that. Now, again, you do that in video anyway, but what we can do with VR now, and in particular, there's a company called Rezl that allow you to do this, is you can replay exact plays, but from the perspective of that player. So pick any player on that field, and you can put yourself in their position exactly where they were and watch that play again from their perspective. And coaches could find that really valuable, right? Like, you might sometimes scratch your head and go, what was the catcher thinking? Why didn't he throw that to second? Or what was the pitcher thinking? Why didn't he see that runner? Well, we can put you in that VR world and see exactly what they were seeing. And maybe there's something that you didn't notice. And I think that's a really crucial one as well. That'd be really nice to sort of enhance the coaching perspective and maybe sort of see what they missed or maybe what they did see.
And also see when they're doing it right too, because I think that's a big proponent. Absolutely. I think as coaches, we've talked about that multiple times here the last month with some of the pro guys that have been on about trying to emphasize when they're doing it right as opposed to spending so much time on when they need to make adjustments and basically saying like, hey, you did this right. We focus so much on when they're not doing it right a lot of the time, where it's like, okay, you did this right and you had the right decision-making on this.
Yeah, that's so true. And even player surprises sometimes. We're like, wow, how did they do that? Like, what were they even thinking to come up with that? And now we can go, okay, so they maybe saw that, whereas every other person in the world didn't see that because for whatever reason, that's what makes them great or that's what makes them the person they are. So.
And then psychological readiness, is that coming off injuries or is that just making sure they can handle the speed of the game?
So the injury one's probably the next one. So this is more to do with sort of anxiety and pressure and to some extent, the speed of the game. So for me, there's probably three major transitions that occur in professional baseball. And every transition between the levels can potentially be a major transition. So I'm not downplaying any single one. But for me, there's going from college or high school to your professional organization. That's going to be a big leap for a lot of players. The second one is Dominican guys or sort of Latin guys coming to America, many of them doing it for the very first time. That's a huge transition culturally, not just in terms of the baseball world. And then the third one is AAA to big league, right? That's the major step. You're suddenly going in front of 50,000 fans potentially. And with each of those, the anxiety, the pressure, the stress, all of those things are going to be huge. So what can we do to try and ease that transition? Well, we can show them what it potentially is going to be like. We can almost give them reps inside Yankee Stadium. We can give them reps inside the American clubhouse. I always say what I would do with the Latin DR guys and all that, like, super easy to do is, a few weeks before they arrive, put a VR headset on them that shows them what it's like to step off that plane, walk across through the airport, walk into the clubhouse, and just sit down at the canteen, right? So simple, so silly. It might even sound a little bit unnecessary, but they then see, they're then prepared for the little things, what it's going to be like in America, essentially.
Yeah, and then you added the caveat on that with the injured players. Guys who can't get reps, actual game reps, they're going to use it to stay sharp.
Yeah, and that's the sixth case. That's the maintaining engagement. And whenever we speak to coaches about VR, one of the big things we get is, is it something that injured players can do? Is it something that rehabbing players can do? Because they've got these guys here essentially doing nothing, right? Like their rehab and work might take half an hour of the day. And for the pro guys, they've potentially got another 5-6 hours to kill if they can't go back to the hotel or wherever it is. And I used to walk through the clubhouse and you'd just walk past them playing Fortnite on their phones or whatever the latest game is on their phones. And, you know, there's a few things you can get them to do. But again, like I was saying earlier, everyone's so busy that we can't always be looking after the players and finding things for them to do. So VR potentially is something that they can be doing there. Now, could it be a placebo? You know, if you just put them in a headset and say, work on this cognitive training, this brain training, whatever you want to call it, is that a placebo? Possibly. Does that matter? I'd argue probably not.
Placebo effect's an actual thing. Like it actually works. Placebo effect works. Yeah.
I say this when we're talking about sort of a range of psychology things. Increasing a player's confidence and sort of almost like happiness and want and desire to be training, like that probably goes above and beyond any sort of slight increase in visual perceptual skill or anything like that, in my opinion. The other thing with that one, I think, is that when you have those injured players and those rehabbing players, it can feel so isolating for them. You know, they're not part of the team as much. They're not sort of constantly interacting with their coaches and their teammates. If you can give them something to do that they think is, you know, part of training and part of their process, then that can sort of be a good thing in terms of their engagement and their morale, basically their well-being. So
we always hear them talk about feeling like they're on an island, and that's one step to actually have coach player interaction, even if it is through VR. They get another touch point from a coach where they don't feel like they're on an island by themselves trying to work through their injury.
Yeah, 100%.
What do you feel like is the best protocol for VR?
Daily? I think if you've got the resources to implement it and the capability to implement it daily, then getting it to become part of a routine, I think you're going to get benefits from. I don't think it's one of those novelty, let's do it every now and again just to prevent boredom, which some people can argue, and that's fine. Like I get that logic. Some technologies are like that. Personally, I don't think VR is. I think if it can be implemented into a routine where, you know, they do it 15 minutes a day, 15 minutes every other day, perhaps, depending on resources, that's how I would love to see it being used. That's, I think we're a far way away from that maybe at the moment, but who knows?
All it takes is one player to do it and have success doing it.
Success,
that's really all it takes. It's because word of mouth spreads like wildfire. If you have one player that's putting up numbers and they're doing it religiously, then you're going to have other people jump on board with it.
Yeah, and you've got to remember, we're still really early days with VR. So good VR is probably only sort of 5-6 years old. So if you're thinking about the types of players that are in the big league doing it, like you're not going to implement it, or it's unlikely to be able to be implemented with those AAA and big league, right? Because they've already got their routines. So it's something that needs to be implemented with the lower guys that then make it and that they become part of their routine. So maybe that's only another year or two away. Hopefully there's someone that's been doing that, building their way up. So,
and we talked about haptics a little bit last time. Has that gotten better as far as feeling when the ball makes contact with the bat?
I'm sure it's gotten better. Is it good enough? I would question it, especially at the very top level, because they're so in tune with their body. They're so aware of the smallest details that maybe would never get there with the technology, right? Because even being 0.01 milliseconds off with it could be crucial. And just the way the technology works, right? Like you've got to send it from the headset to the computer and then back again. And even that smallest of times could be something that an Aaron Judge notices and makes a difference for him. So do we ever get there? Maybe, but I don't think we're there yet again.
Anything new on the horizon for skill acquisition?
Did you see, do you know Rob Gray? Have you heard of Rob Gray?
I do know Rob Gray.
Yeah. So he had a nice paper came out last week, which, or a couple of weeks ago, that you
he's
may
probably
have.
The expert, isn't he, on skill acquisition? Yeah, he's the expert, isn't he?
I think, especially when you're talking baseball skill acquisition, I can't think of anyone that's more in this area, more knowledgeable in this area than Rob. And he produced what I think is a beautiful paper called Practicing the Wrong Way. Did you see it?
I haven't, but I'm going to read it now.
Nah. Yeah, so I can send it to you after. I'll give a brief summary. Basically, he took what ended up being sort of three different groups of players, and one of the groups were instructed to intentionally try to pop up or intentionally try to ground ball it, intentionally try to foul it out left, foul it out right. So they're instructed to practice the wrong way. And the scientists and the academics may argue that that's not really practicing the wrong way. So that's partly semantics, in my opinion. But it's a really interesting study because, as far as I'm aware, that's new to the area. We don't really instruct people to practice the wrong way. We instruct people to explore different ways of doing things. And there's loads of literature on what we call differential learning, where people are trying to do different ways and trying to explore their body and the different processes and techniques. But actually telling someone the wrong goal and the wrong aim is new, as far as I'm aware. And he did this very impressive in terms of sort of length and players and involvement. He did this very long study, and he basically found that this was better for them. This was superior in terms of their end skills than traditional training. And it's logical because you're exploring more, you're understanding more about your capabilities and the space, and the scientific word, I guess, would be what we call it, affordances, essentially what you can and can't do.
Your end ranges.
And
find your end ranges.
Yes, exactly. And so the idea and the conclusions were logical, but like I said before, I'm not aware of anyone that's actually done that before, and it's really interesting. I definitely recommend yourself and listeners.
Yeah, because it honestly, there's time and place for fouling balls off. Honestly, obviously not put in play, but yeah, you always think about the better hitters that you either coached along the way. They were able to fight pitches off and get them out of there without putting them in play just to buy them another pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. I did speak to a friend not long after the paper came out there, and I said, "Oh, have you seen this?" And he said, he's a coach, and he said, "There's absolutely no way that could get implemented at the big league level." And I did think, yeah, you're right.
But it's something to think about. And again, that's where the science research part comes in. Like, it's a good question because nobody's ever really thought about it. Like, would this be a better way to train at times where you're trying to get into your end range? And also, probably teaching hitters a little bit more of a barrel manipulation piece to it too, where they're developing better feel for their barrel because they're trying to miss hit balls rather than square balls up, where they get a little bit of feel for that too. And would that, if you do work on that every once in a while, does that allow you a better capability of actually squaring the ball up more consistently because you're working and training that sometimes?
Yeah, I think that's the logic. I think it's so interesting, and I've been sort of racking my brain of, how can you apply this to different sports? Could I do a replication study with a different sport? But I think baseball is quite nicely suited to that because, as you just said, like there are ways when fouling off is not necessarily like a bad thing or like a wrong way. And not all sports have that sort of equivalent, I guess.
Anything you've changed your mind on here recently?
That really requires me to remember what my mindset was 2.5 years ago. That's a good question. I'm not sure. I guess I know that I changed my mind from sort of 10 years ago on, say, you know, pre New York Yankees. I was very much a case of practice, correct practice can take you almost anywhere. But then my time at the Yankees did make me realize that there's some people that are just special. maybe that's a careful thing that I should say, but there are. You can't look at the judges and go, okay, he didn't, you know, have something about him. So that's not something that's changed in the last, since we last spoke, but it's definitely something that, you know, when people say, has your mindset changed? That's something I do think of. Yeah.
The elite of the elite. They're different. Yeah. They are born different. They come out different. You know, yes, they do work, but there are some, and you can go across every sport and there's going to be people that you can point out where, well, Ovechkin's a good guy's the all-time scoring leader for the NHL. I don't think he works extremely hard when you look at his background. I don't think Ovechkin, that ESPN 30 for 30 they did on him, I mean, he likes to get after it off the, once he's done, like, I don't think he's working hard, but he's highly skilled at what he does.
Yeah, I'll have to watch that. Ice hockey's not that big a sport, but I did see that story. Yeah, and there's other examples you can point to. It's slightly different, I guess, with someone like Usain Bolt, where physical prowess is obviously super important, but obviously there's stories about him. In boxing, you have people like Tyson Fury. Like, there's definitely examples that you can point to. I never like to say that players are born with something, but for the, yeah, what other way can you say it, right?
And I asked too, is there time for block training? I know everybody likes to talk about the difference between block and random, and I did want to revisit that too, because I still think there's a time for it, especially with different age groups.
Do you know what?
I wanted to kind of get your opinions again on that, the block versus random training piece too.
Yeah, I mean, you just said you want to get back into it. I think now's quite a good time, because there's been a couple of studies recently that have gone back into that area, and that's quite an... For skill acquisition, that's one of the older areas, I guess. And it's always been, as you were saying, the idea that random's always best, block's not really that good. But it is starting to emerge now that, as with the case in most things, it's not that simple. And maybe for especially the younger guys and sort of early on in the learning process, that block could be useful in other situations. It's not an area that I've done research in, but I do teach it, so I have some familiarity, and it's definitely something that I think is worth following for the next sort of 5-10 years, because I do think that picture will become a bit more nuanced, and understanding that could be advantageous to people. So
have you dove into the torpedo bats at all?
No, but I did speak to Aaron Leinhart, who, according to all the articles, is the mastermind behind it. And I'll be honest, that does not surprise me, because the guy's a genius. So, yeah, that was nice to see. I do have bat-related ideas for studies. I'm not sure where the torpedo aspect comes into that, but it's interesting. It's very interesting. It's died down a little bit since the Yankees slowed off, hasn't it?
Yeah, but, it always does. But it makes sense. But you know, again, they tested it. Like, that's the thing. Like, there was a lot of testing with individual players to go into that. And it's not like they're all using it. But again, that's where the testing piece comes in with the individual. And if they hit the ball closer to the label, then that's probably a good fit for them.
Yeah, and it's one of those that it comes out and it's like, this is so obvious. How has it taken 150 years? For someone to do this. And I was speaking to a colleague and who's huge into baseball, knows way more than I do. And I was saying, like, surely there's been other bats, right? Like, someone's done this before. And he sent me a nice article about various bats, not crazes, I don't know if that's the right term, but sort of differences in the past. But yeah, apparently this is pretty new. So who would have thought?
Yeah, I mean, but... I guess when I look at it, it reminds me of like an old C-243. Like their Louisville Slugger had different models, and the barrels were shaped different, but probably not that extreme. But there have been preferences with larger handles and larger barrels and skinnier handles, mm-hmm. skinnier barrels. There has, but not to this extent.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It probably. delves into the biomechanics a lot more, whereas my area is sort of vision, perception, and cognition. So it'd be interesting to see what sort of a biomechanist would say about it. And like you said, you know, people have probably tested it loads, so there is obviously strong logic to it. Yeah, it's interesting. I like it.
When I saw it, from a cognitive standpoint, with brain scans, those areas of basically guessing and perception where an object's going to end up, they're stronger in those areas, correct?
In terms of, are we talking bat still now?
I'm talking about vision training. I'm talking about cognition. I just think the elite of the elite, I think their vision is better, but I also think they can guess better with a ball moving in space where it's going to end up.
Yeah, I think it's going to be specific to sort of like baseball type tasks, right? So do they have better just sort of general vision? Maybe. I don't think that's as conclusive as perhaps some people assume, but they definitely have better sort of baseball specific vision and baseball specific cognition and baseball specific perception. So yeah, I mean, that's why I was hired, I guess, is to try and exploit that evidence. So yeah.
Would you change anything if you got rehired by the Yankees and went back? What would you would you start with now? Not that you're starting over, but even if you went back, what would you do some things differently?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I guess there's a lot of things we trialed and errored. So if I could go back, then I would sort of just cut out that trial and error part, right, and just get to the end point. But that would be cheating, so I don't know if that's allowed. I did learn some things. I learned that you can't just educate the coaches. You have to educate the players as well. We thought, okay, you got to go in there. You got to tell the coaches why we want to do these things and why we want to make these changes. And we thought we were quite clever about doing that. But we didn't think about the players at all. And actually, the players also need to know, okay, why is their training changing? Why are they starting to do these different things? So I definitely changed that. That was, in hindsight, like an obvious mistake to make, but at the time it didn't seem that much of an issue. So I changed that. I'd like to think, you know, relationship building. I thought I was quite good at that, but again, you can always be better, and that's such a crucial part to baseball and to coaching and to practice. So yeah, I don't know if I'd do anything differently. I'd just do things a little bit quicker and maybe a little bit better, I guess.
And it is a player-driven approach. And let's be honest, they're going to be their best coaches. And coaching does matter, but for a lot of them, they're going to be their best coaches when they need it.
Yeah, and it kind of links back to the whole, you know, using a T situation. I wouldn't ever support it, but if a player wants to use it, I'd never take it away from a player. You know, what a player wants to do, for a large part, I think, you know, they know themselves, like you were saying.
Yeah, it's just, there's so many outliers and so much gray area with it that there are some things that maybe in theory wouldn't work, but in practice they do work. And so that's where you have to have a bunch of different things to introduce to players, because you never know what one's going to work for one player, maybe work for another. And that's why you do have to introduce a bunch of different things. But that's also confidence in the routine too. I think with the T, I think that's where the confidence in the routine comes from, where should you be using it? Maybe, maybe not. But that's where, if you have confidence in the routine that you're using, it is going to show up with on-field performance.
Yeah, 100%. And that's why I think, you know, you're not going to be able to take a T away from someone who's at AA, AAA, higher, but maybe you can a little bit lower down, because those routines perhaps aren't as cemented. I don't know.
You have many students at La Trobe that are interested in baseball?
Not many, but when you find a couple that are, they are really into it, which is nice to see. So I've got a couple of students right now, and he got me into watching The Clubhouse on Netflix.
Awesome.
He was like, you need to watch this.
It's all, anybody that hasn't watched, I've been shouting it from the rooftops here since I watched it. It was recommended by a former player and assistant coach of mine. And then if you have not watched Clubhouse about the Red Sox season last season, I think it's some of the best television, if you're especially if you're a baseball person.
Yeah.
I just think it's great for the general fan who doesn't understand how hard it is to play the game. I think that's where it's going to have the most value of people not screaming at baseball players as much anymore if you watch that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice show, isn't it?
It's great.
It doesn't sort of paint much in a bad light, if that makes sense. Like, it shows how hard it can be, but it's not sort of digging into sort of negative stories or anything like that. So, which is, I like that in a TV show.
How's your classroom set up for your classes?
In terms of?
How do you set it? From classroom design, do you do anything different with your classes? Do you have many? Is it online? Is it in class? What do you have a mix?
So we have, it's kind of 50-50. We have half of it online and then we have half of it in person. The more things you can get doing with them rather than actually just sort of talking at them, that's generally better, right? That no one wants to hear me, although we've been yapping for half an hour now. Nobody normally likes to do that with me. So when I can get them actually doing things, they quite like it. We're going to be doing a bit of they love Australian rules football. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. They love it here, so I've had to learn that a little bit so that we can do those sorts of activities here, and cricket as well, so that's nice. But unfortunately, not too much baseball activities yet.
How have you had to adjust with going to more online classes?
Do you know what? At first, when we first moved into it, I thought, oh, this is better. This will be easier. You know, you're just talking rather than doing something live in front of 300 students and talking at them. But actually, it's way more effort. It is way more effort putting together a video. Because you want it to be perfect then, right? Whereas if it's live, you can make a mistake and it's all right, it's fine. You just explain yourself and you can clarify things when a student looks confused. Whereas online, you can't see if a student looks confused. So you can say something that's you think makes sense and maybe someone doesn't. It's harder than I thought it was going to be, but we're used to it now. We've probably been doing it 3 or 4 years. So.
Yeah, it's crazy. I would have not been good with online classes. I needed interaction in the classroom with
yeah.
my professors. I needed that. I mean, you would adjust, but you know, one of my kids is all online. One of my kids is split yeah. hybrid, but the one he loves it though. My oldest, he loves all online, but I don't. It would have been really really hard for me. And it seems like it's more work on the student too. It seems like you're. Seems almost more like high school because you're having to check a lot more.
Yeah, and I think it definitely requires more self-discipline from the students, which perhaps is not a forte of the younger generations right now. But I think if you're brought up right now through that system, you're probably used to it. And you still want that mix because students will always still want that interaction, not just with the teacher, but with the other students as well, probably more so actually. So they still want that mix. I'd be surprised if there's many students who want fully online. But yeah, I'd have been the same. I don't know if I'd have liked that much online. So.
Yeah. Do you have a new fail forward moment? Something you thought was going to set you back, but looking back now helped you move forward?
Ooh, what did I say last time?
I haven't checked.
I'm not sure. That is a good question. I think you warned me last time, didn't you? But I should have remembered. Do you know what? So I left the Yankees because my now wife, was unable to get a work visa at the time. And so we didn't want to leave, but it was kind of like, you know, she's worked really hard throughout her university life to sort of get this qualification, which she now can't use. So we made the decision, look, it's only fair, let's go back to England. And then sort of just before I was leaving, I was speaking to one of the higher ups at the Yankees and he said, you should have let us know, we might have been able to pull some strings. And maybe I should have done. I sometimes look back on that conversation and think, I'd love to still be doing stuff like that. We spoke earlier before we started this and you said, do you miss America? And I was like, I miss the baseball. And that is very true. So that failure to sort of inquire about that is maybe something that I sometimes think about, but it's led me to where I am right now. And actually, with all that said, I don't know if I would change where I am right now. I absolutely love it here. Really love what I do. Really love the life in Australia. So yeah, that failure, which I do still look back on and think, what if, it's led me to where
at least
I am,
you know, to ask now. I mean, that's the teaching point of that, is because if you don't ask, the answer is always no. So it's like, okay, I need to ask this question. It might be awkward and I might get told no, but if you don't ask, then the answer is always no. So
absolutely. And that goes to anyone listening as well. If you're in that a similar-ish situation, just ask.
Ask. And you have openings here for master's PhD students at La Trobe?
Yeah, we've got a couple of nice projects, but it's dependent on sort of the right students, just because the funding process to get a scholarship, which most students would probably need, it's just so competitive. So we have a couple baseball related projects that, if it's a right student, would be, I think, a fantastic opportunity. We probably don't need to talk about them now, but I can send you a LinkedIn link and maybe you can put it on the podcast.
Yeah, that's why I'm not in your shoes and I coached baseball, because I couldn't get into a master's program for psychology. That's true. My GRE was not high enough. I maybe should have went to law school, because my the logic was perfect, but that's why I did not end up going to psych grad school, because it's so competitive to get in, and my GRE scores weren't good enough, and I wasn't going to retake it. But that's also a fail forward moment too for me. It's like, okay, I didn't score well enough, but I probably didn't put enough time in to score well enough on it, and that's what pivoted me to doing what I'm doing now, which is what I'm supposed to be doing. That's the great
thing. Yeah, I was going to say.
That's the great thing with life. It's like, you think at the time, it's like, oh, I don't know, what am I doing? But then you look up, it's like, okay, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, definitely.
Have your routines changed at all? Any morning or evening routines changed for you?
No, I'm still very much a morning person. Perhaps even more so now, actually. I go to bed earlier. I think that's just probably an age thing, though. I think that's gradually what happens, isn't it? But no, I'm. Yeah,
I don't. What do you like about the mornings?
I maybe this is an odd one, but I feel like I'm getting ahead of everyone else. if I've worked out by 6 a.m., I'm one step ahead of everyone else, and I like that feeling about it. So maybe that's a little bit competitive of me. A little bit unnecessary, but that's what I quite like about it.
I do too. When I'm up at 4:30 and doing stuff, people are like, "How?" I'm like, and I was not a morning person. I was an evening person for a long time. Yeah. Yep. It's changed over time, but I feel the exact same way. I feel like you win the day when you get up and you've gotten stuff knocked out and you've already gotten stuff done. You know, 98% of the human population is still in bed. Like, it does give you some motivation and it does make you feel good.
Yeah. One thing I will caveat, so it doesn't sound like I'm super weird. So I will be up at, like, you know, between 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. most days, but I'm a very big napper and I support and endorse napping very much. So I will have a nap many days. So yeah, I'm up super early. I go to bed super early, but also have a nap often. So that's my one piece of
advice. When do you usually nap?
To be honest, whenever I can fit it in. It sounds bad, but
15 minutes? You go longer than 15 minutes sometimes?
No, I'm not one of those short-term nappers. It will be like a 45-minute nap, I think, so, which I don't know if that's best. We have a couple of colleagues who do a lot of sleep research in our department. They'd probably say that's not best for you, because you wake
up
in the middle.
You're in the middle of your different cycles.
Yeah.
I think they say like below 30 and 90, because the sleep cycle basically starts, I think, 30. So I think that in between 30 to 90-minute range is where you might be a little sluggish.
Yeah,
but that's a human thing. If that works for you, it works for you. Like, those are just averages. So yeah, you might be great with 45 minutes.
Yeah, who knows?
Any other books or podcasts you're diving into right now?
Do they have to be baseball related?
No. We have a diverse group, so it could be anything. I think this group that listens actually likes the different outlier stuff too. It doesn't have to be baseball.
I'm very big into podcasts and audiobooks. I've been listening to Stephen Fry. Is he known in America?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so Stephen Fry is sort of a well-known figure in England, sort of a national treasure, I'd probably say. Does acting, does presenting, author, just general sort of polymath, I guess. And he's done a lot of books on sort of Greek mythology. And so, like I said, completely random, not baseball related, but I've been listening to those on audiobooks, and those are brilliant. So I would recommend, if anyone wants something slightly different, I'd definitely recommend them. More related to sport, good question, actually. Not sure. I was big into Greek and Roman mythology as a kid.
I read a lot of Greek and Roman mythology when I was a kid. The stories are phenomenal.
Yeah, I like it.
What else we need to touch on? What do you want to touch on? Anything?
I like that we talked about the VR. That's what I wanted to sort of chat about. I could talk about that all day. So I'm glad we've done that. I'm good.
Okay, perfect. What are some final thoughts before I let you go?
Nap, Stephen Fry, and implement VR into baseball if you're someone working in baseball.
Love it. Appreciate you, sir. Thanks again for your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me on. Yep.
It's always great to connect with Dr. Wilkins. He's one of the brightest minds we have in the sports industry. I love that he's willing to ask questions and challenge them through the scientific method. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, and Matt West in the ABCA office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email at rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok at CoachB_ABCA, or direct message me via the My ABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you.